are huge Rick Steves fans, and we are also so lucky that we have this partnership with Dominican University and the wonderful faculty, staff, and students, and especially with Dr. Denise Lucy, the founder and leader of the Institute for Leadership Studies, who makes it possible for you to enjoy these fabulous speakers who challenge us and bring us information from all different fields. In order that we all enjoy it to the fullest, I would really be thrilled if you would turn your phones off or to vibrate. So if you could do that, I'd appreciate it. When you came in tonight, the ushers, I think, gave you a form, an evaluation form to fill out. If you will fill them out and pass them to the ends of your rows, they'll be glad to pick them up. And if you do put your contact information on it, Dominican has promised, and Dominican would not lie to you, that this information will be used for one purpose and one purpose only, and that is to let you know of upcoming speakers, so you'll be one of the first to know. You can also find out on the Dominican website and on the Book Passage website, but you'll know first if you get on this list. Tonight's lecture will be recorded and will be on http://radio.dominican.edu. So when you go home and you tell your friend or your loved ones what they missed, poor things, they can see it too. One of the things I just wanted to say is that Rick will be signing after the lecture in the lobby. There will also be a short break so that in the middle of the lecture so that you can spend more money or go to the ladies' room or whatever. I'm particularly proud of Rick. I'm not the one to introduce him, but I did want to mention that Travel as a Political Act has won the Lowell Thomas Award as the best travel book of the year. And so here we are. And now I would like to turn things over to my partner in, I hope not crime, the woman I love working with, Dr. Denise Lucy.
Thank you, Elaine, so much. And thank you for coming again to Dominican University of California's Institute for Leadership Studies. Our lecture series has just been a thrilling opportunity to bring our community here onto campus and to engage in great ideas and discussions. So it's really terrific to have you back here tonight. And of course, our travel expert, Rick Steves, is going to speak about travel as a political act. But before he does, we just wanted to mention a few things. One, of course, is that this lecture series is part of our institute. We are an institute of leadership development. And the topic for this evening's presentation fits so very well. Rick talks about how we all change the world, and that's exactly what we seek to try to do at our institute, is to help our students to better be prepared for that. I wanted to also mention that this series, as Elaine has said to you, is a partnership with us, and I want to thank Bill Petruccelli, who is also here this evening. Thank you, Bill, for everything you always do for us. In the 30 years, you and Elaine have made a difference in our community, so can we thank them, please? For those of you who are here for the first time, we do offer these programs almost once a month, 3 to 4 times a semester. And we have just recently had Roseanne Cash and Marlo Thomas here, as well as Robert Reich. This is the last program for this fall, and we are so thrilled that you're here this evening. But you will be able to watch on Community Access Television Marin Comcast Cable TV 30. Community Media Center of Marin will be showing 13 of our former lectures on television and through January 19th. And again, channel TV 30, we hope that you will watch them once per week. I wanted to also thank Marin Magazine. Marin Magazine is a beautiful display of Marin, and we can't thank them enough for always being our media sponsor. So thank you so much to Marin Magazine. Some special recognitions this evening. This evening's event has been hosted in part by Dominican's Women Leadership and Philanthropy Council. The council's mission is to engage women to make a difference. And if you would like to become a member, please do. There's information out in the lobby. We hope you will join us. We also want to thank three very important sponsors: Dimensions in Travel, Frosch International Travel, and TravelSmith. Thank you. May we thank them for their support this evening. And most especially to my colleagues who are students here this evening, all of them have volunteered their time to spend greeting you and making you feel welcome. I hope they have done that. Thank you so much to our students. To introduce Mr. Steves is Bill Grayson, financial advisor of Bernstein Global Wealth Management. He has served on the Board of Trustees here at Dominican University and is also on the Business Advisory Council here at our School of Business and Leadership. He is a trustee at the Bay Area Discovery Museum. He has received several awards, including the Outstanding Civilian Service Medal by the Secretary of the Army. He has served on the President's Commission on White House Fellowships, and he has served as a stock market commentator on KRN-TV, and it is my pleasure to introduce to you Mr. Bill Grayson.
Thank you, Dr. Lucy. I'm the only thing standing between all of you and Rick Steves, so I promise you I will be very brief. I'm sure a lot of you in this auditorium feel the same way, but I feel as though I've known Rick forever, even though I've only met him tonight for the first time, and I'm sure you have that feeling because he's been so fabulous in sharing his views of travel around the world, which is why we're all here tonight. But his story is amazing. At the age of 14, he went with his family on his first trip to Europe to see his relatives in Norway. And I had a similar experience when I was 14, and I went to Europe for the first time with my family, and we did, instead of one country, we did 13 in about 3 weeks. And so we tried to smash it all in there, but what I would have done to have had Rick's great books back then to guide me through all those 13 countries would have really been something. I think the greatest thing about Rick's book, which, as Elaine said, is award-winning in so many ways, is that travel as a political act is really a very interesting concept, but it's really what we all do when we travel. And the beauty of that first trip, wherever it may be in any part of the world, is that you get to see things in such a totally different way. Your eyes are open to religions, to government, to food, to people, to customs, to costumes, you name it. And if you look at Rick's blogs or look at his website, which I highly encourage, in addition to buying as many copies as Travel as a Political Act as you possibly can, you'll see on one of his recent blogs, he quotes Mark Twain, who was, as we all know, another great traveler. And I think Mark Twain's quote sums up perfectly what Rick is all about, which is probably why he used it. And the quote is this: travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness. And there's no way you can travel to any part of the world and not experience those fatalities to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness. And I think that is really the essence, to me, of the beauty of what Rick Steves delivers to all of us and to his millions of viewers around the world. I wanted to say one more thing. In addition to being this internet sensation, TV sensation, the great author that he is, he's also an excellent piano player, and I don't know if we're gonna roll out a piano later, but maybe we'll get a treat to that. There is one more thing I want to say, and that is that a recent newspaper credited Rick with being responsible for more boarding passes than any other single human entity, travel agent, airline, cruise line in the entire world. Or put it another way, close to our hearts here in the Bay Area, Rick Steves is to travel what the San Francisco Giants are to baseball, and that is a true world champion. So with that, let's give a big, warm Dominican and book passage welcome to our good friend, Rick Steves.
Thank you, thank you. Thank you so much. And do I need to turn this on, or are we ready? Testing, there we go. Yeah, it is great to be here, and what a fun opportunity to share the lessons I've learned from spending a third of my adult life living out of a 9x22x14-inch carry-on the airplane-sized suitcase. I never wanted to go to Europe. As was mentioned, I was dragged over there when I was 14 years old by my mom and dad to see relatives in Norway, and my dad imported pianos from Germany, so I distinctly remember not wanting to go. I thought it was a stupid idea. And 14-year-old with a bad attitude in Europe with his mom and dad there, and I remember like on day three it occurred to me, you know, this is not all that bad. There was different candy, different pop, there were one-armed bandits in the hotel lobbies I could gamble. I distinctly remember statuesque women with hairy armpits. I went again a couple of years later to see the piano factories in Germany and the relatives in Norway. And I remember I was in the Copenhagen train station with my mom and dad, and there were kids all around me just a couple years older than me with Eurail passes and rucksacks on their back and exciting destinations clicking up on those reader boards. You know, the old-fashioned train station reader boards, Berlin, Amsterdam, Oslo. And I looked at those kids, and like Europe was their playground. And I remember looking at my mom and dad thinking, I don't really need you guys for this. I could be like those kids. And I vowed to go back to Europe every year after that on my own, and I have. For the first three or four trips, it was just traveling purely for kicks. I was a piano teacher. Kids wouldn't practice in the summer, so I thought, I'm not going to push this. I'll see you in September. I'm going to Europe. And I was on a tight budget, and I was learning a lot of tricks, and it occurred to me after three or four years, man, I've learned from my lessons. I'm getting to be quite a good traveler, and I saw other people, smart American travelers, without the experience I had, making the same mistakes I learned from the previous year. And I thought, that's a shame, you know? I mean, if I could just package the lessons I learned from my experience, put it into a guidebook or a talk or whatever, other people could learn from my mistakes rather than their own and travel smoother, and I would have a good excuse to go back to Europe every summer and update my material, you see. So I eventually became a travel teacher. I remember when I was an idealistic college kid, I thought, I want to do something productive and good. I want to work hard. I just thought, is this a noble thing to do to encourage Americans for traveling? I just thought, is this really the right thing to do? For in my image of travel back then, the very early kind of American tourism from the 50s and 60s, my image was Americans on big cruise ships in the Caribbean throwing nickels off the deck and photographing, do you remember this, what they called the little dark kids jumping for their coins. That really turned on American travelers back in the 50s and 60s. People would come home and brag about that. And I just thought, that's not the kind of travel I want to be a part of. And even today, that notion of travel persists for a lot of Americans. I mean, for a lot of Americans, travel is still, see if you can eat five meals a day and still snorkel when you get into port. Now, when I say that at a cruise convention, people fidget nervously in their seats, thinking, where is he going to go with this? And I'm not saying that in a judgmental way. I got no problem with cruises. I think they're very good, but it's not travel. It's hedonism, you know? And I don't say that in a judgmental way either. I've got no problem with hedonism. I'm a Lutheran. But I wanted to work really hard and promote a kind of travel that brings people together rather than exacerbates the gap between us and the rest of the world. It was kind of clear to me. A positive thing about travel is it gives you empathy with the rest of the world. It gives you a broader perspective, and it helps you better understand where your society is compared to the other 96% of humanity. So when I look back on my teaching, this has been my passion. It hasn't always been the primary thing. I've written 30 books, and I see my teaching themes coming out each decade. In the 1980s, it was all about Europe through the back door. That was, you know, budget tricks, budget skills. It's still my lead guidebook. It's the handbook for how to travel. In the 1990s, it was appreciating art and history in your travels. And then since 9/11, basically, my interest in teaching has been inspiring Americans to become people with a broader worldview in order for us to fit more comfortably on this complicated planet. And it's kind of like Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Remember that thing? And you do your basic needs first, and then you get into finer things, and pretty soon you get creative and altruistic and fulfilled. Well, the bottom rungs would be, you know, eating, sleeping, getting clothes, putting a roof over your head, catching the train, knowing how to get, you know, stay healthy, use the travel agent, use the tourist information office, find the guided tour, and then appreciate the art and the history, and now learn to travel in a way that you come home with the most beautiful souvenir possible, a broader perspective. So I want to talk about that particular important dimension of travel this evening. How can we travel in a way that gives us a broader perspective, and why is that even a good thing? It's a little awkward because I got the mic and I can just hammer away all my little passions and so on. And I want to say I don't feel like, well, first of all, everybody in this room cares. I'll just assume that. We all care. We all have a different worldview based on our own life experience. And what I have to share is the fact that I've spent a third of my adult life, 4 months a year, hanging out with people who find different truths to be self-evident and God-given. And I've learned it's humbling. It's a beautiful thing. It tears down your ethnocentricity, and you realize that it's just smart to give everybody on this planet a little wiggle room. Then we can all share it comfortably together. And when you think about the discourse in our society today, and all the fear that's running around, think of the fear that's being peddled in our beautiful country today. And what's the agenda behind that fear? There's always an agenda when somebody wants to make you afraid. And I've found that I've been afraid lots. And in my travels, I find that the flip side of fear is understanding. And you gain understanding when you travel. Lately, my theme has been fear is for people who don't get out very much. And we'll talk about that. Okay. When, I'll get into that in just a minute. I just want to make a couple little announcements here because I sent down some goodies that I want to make sure you have, and I'll just do a little housekeeping, then we'll get into this. First of all, I'm going to talk for, I think, about an hour, then we're going to take like a 10-minute break, and then I'll talk for another half an hour. And then I'll be happy to hang out in the lobby afterwards and sign books or answer questions or get photographs, whatever you like. I had the great experience to collaborate with the Smithsonian Magazine people on a magazine, and they had me write the entire thing. And it's like 100 pages, and they wanted to showcase my favorite 20 destinations in Europe. And it was a beautiful experience to work with these great people at Smithsonian. They are masters at making great magazines, and it was really an honor to share that with them. I liked what they produced so much, I bought 50,000 copies, and I give them away wherever I go. So I hope that you can grab one of these Smithsonian magazines, please, one per traveling family, just so we can spread it around, because I don't have enough for absolutely everybody here, but I hope you can grab that. I employ 80 people up in Edmonds at Europe Through the Back Door. We produce a TV show and a radio show that airs all over the country in 150 stations for an hour each week. Have a very generous website where you can watch the TV shows or listen to the radio shows if you don't get it in your community or whatever. We make 30 guidebooks covering all of Western Europe. We take 400 groups around Europe every year. Last year we took 10,000 Americans around Europe. It's a big part of our business. This is a brochure I had shipped down just for those who are curious about our tour program, if you'd like. This explains the 25 different itineraries that we're very proud of. And it's got a DVD inside, really designed to scare away high-maintenance travelers. All right. If you watch that DVD and you like what you see, it'll be the trip of a lifetime, but it may not look very appealing. So it's just fun to be able to be really straight in our promotion. But that's available in the lobby if you like. Also, I've been coming down to Corte Madeira for 20 years, and all I know in Corte Madeira is Book Passage, because that's in Elaine and Bill's house. I just love coming here. You guys have the greatest independent bookstore, and I just think it's really important. And Elaine and Bill are passionate travelers. They really believe in books and the value of equipping travelers to travel smart. And their staff is out here with a few books in the lobby that might be interesting for you. I've got guidebooks for each country in Europe, and they only have the latest editions, of course. I've got guidebooks for the great cities of Europe. And the skills book I have, which is the flagship of the 30 books that I've written, is Europe Through the Back Door. This is where I pack lessons from all of my experience. If you came here tonight hoping to hear a budget travel talk, this is the budget travel talk right here, okay? And one of my delights every year is packing the lessons I learned from my experience into the new edition, and this is the new 30th edition, just came out, and it would share with you the nitty-gritty lessons on all the latest in Europe. I mean, there's a lot of changes in Europe. There's little chips in credit cards now, you know, so your magnetic next strip won't work as readily as you might hope. It's not a big deal, but you should understand what's going on. There's those kind of technical changes that you need to be on top of. Right now, they've opened up a new museum in Athens that just will blow you away, the Acropolis Museum. And if you don't have an up-to-date guidebook, you're going to go to the wrong museum, I think. So it's important for your trip to equip yourself with good information and expect yourself to travel smart. And that's what these books attempt to do. And then if you're thinking you better take a lot of notes in the next hour and a half, if you have this book, you don't need to, because this book is what I wrote after having so much fun giving this talk. So this fills out everything I'm going to say tonight in much more depth in the context of field studies in Morocco or Turkey or Denmark or El Salvador or Iran or whatever. So that's the book for today is Travel as a Political Act, and I'll be happy to sign them out in the lobby later on. As a travel teacher, it's so exciting to turn people onto the magic of travel. And there's a lot of magic in travel. I mean, natural wonders. We got great natural wonders here, but the fun thing about Europe's natural wonders is they're so accessible. You have breakfast in your hotel in the morning, hop on the lift, and by 9 o'clock, you're on top of the world. And then you can walk on this ridge. It's like tightroping on a ridge for 3 hours. On one side, you got lakes stretching all the way to Germany. On the other side, you got the most incredible alpine panorama anywhere, the Eiger-Monken-Jungfrau. Cut glass alpine peaks into the sky. And ahead of you, you hear the long legato tones of an Alp horn, announcing that the helicopter-stocked mountain hut is open, it's just around the corner, and the coffee schnapps is on. That's a great moment. I mean, anybody can be on top of that Alp making that hike with the local people. And that's the you just gain an appreciation for nature in your travels. You also gain an appreciation for culture. Now, every country has its culture, and Americans are kind of rugged individuals, and we have our passions, and you go to Europe, and sometimes it seems like they're a little bit over the top with their culture. I mean, cheese. These darn French people, they got a different cheese for every day of the year. You step into a cheese shop, and it's like a festival of mold. I grew up thinking cheese is no big deal. It's orange in the shape of the bread. Here you go, cheese sandwich. And then you go over there, and they're just crazy. They're evangelical about their cheese. I remember, you've probably seen me with my friend in Paris, if you watch the TV show. She loves taking this American bumpkin shopping in the morning. And, you know, what I like about a good little restaurant is they don't know what's going to be on the menu tonight. My mark of a good restaurant is a handwritten menu determined by what looks good in the morning when they go shopping. You see? That's really, really exciting. And she takes me into the cheese shop. Oh, this goat cheese, goat, goat, goat. And she takes up the moldiest wad. Oh, Rick, smell this cheese. It smells like the feet of angels. Wow, I didn't know cheese was that exciting, you know? But a lot of Americans are put off by this. You know, I, for 25 years, took Americans around Europe, and I know that that challenges a lot of Americans. They think, are you telling me you're more sophisticated than me? We fought and died for your freedoms, and I'm not going to sit here and let you tell me that stinky cheese is good, you know? Well, it's not better than anybody. It's like an exuberance. It's an embracing life. It's like third grade show and tell. And I think it's something that a good mindset to be is let them show off and celebrate it. You don't need to go home and abandon your kind of cheese. But while you're there, try their cheese. It really makes things go better. History comes to life when you're traveling. I got a history degree at the University of Washington accidentally, because I had been traveling. I remember waking up in the dorm one morning and it occurred to me, I've taken 7 history classes, 3 more and I'm a historian. I didn't even plan it. It just was fun to take history classes because I had been there. And I think as a tour guide, this has been a real passion of mine, and a fun thing is to make history fun for travelers. History's now, history's happening. It's not something dead in the books. We are living in exciting times. 100 years from now, there'll be entire classes dedicated to our generation, you know? And we're right there in the midst of it. Have that understanding. Be swept away by thrilling happenings today. Let sights take you back to heady times when Europe was coming out of the Dark Ages or whatever. I mean, when you're in Berlin, you're going to see the new Reichstag building. Now, you know, Germany was divided, and then after the Cold War, comes back together again. The government goes from Bonn back to Berlin. For all of many of our lifetimes, we have this bombed out hulk of a parliament building on the no man's land of the Berlin Wall, remember? Blackened, bombed out Reichstag. gripping history. Germany is united back in Berlin. They need a good capital in good European style. They don't bulldoze the old building and build a new one. They renovate the historic building, fix it up, and incorporate a modern architectural element into it. This incredible glass dome, it's free, open long hours, designed primarily for Germans, but tourists are more than welcome to go in there, climb this spiral ramp all the way to the very top. And from that top, you look over the down, literally over the shoulders of the legislators down there. Powerful architectural symbolism. Germans have been jerked around too much in the last century by their politicians, and this is going to stay loud and clear. This is government by, for, and of the people. We're going to keep an eye on you. You're our public servants, you see. And I was up there on opening day. Just was lucky I was in town on opening day. I was on top of that beautiful dome, surrounded by teary-eyed Germans. Now, anytime you're surrounded by teary-eyed Germans, something exceptional is going on. And it occurred to me, whoa, this is so cool. I'm up here with eyes that remember Berlin when it was just a pile of rubble. And now, with the opening of this glorious new parliament building, they're celebrating a new beginning. No more communism, no more fascism, no more division. A united country opening a new century with a new capital building looking into a promising future. It was thrilling to be there with those Germans, aware of what the meaning of this was. And I looked around at the other tourists up there, the other American tourists up there, and it occurred to me, not one of them had a clue how exciting this was. And it saddened me. I thought, they're dumbed down. Look at these people. And then I thought, I'm living in a dumbed down society. I'm living in a society that celebrates dumbed downness. And it really, I just decided in my own little realm as a travel writer, I'm not going to put up with that. I'm going to expect my readers and my tourists and my viewers to be smartened up instead of dumbed down. This is really important. You're going to find in the near future an anti-intellectualism that's going to make a lot of people who are just thoughtful little identified as, you know, stuck-up elites or something like this. This is not good for the fabric of our communities. And anytime somebody's trying to dumb you down, I think they've got an agenda. Think about how public television is so offensive to a lot of people. It's because it respects your intellect. It assumes an attention span. It's not shaped by advertiser interests. And you can call the 800 number below here, and our volunteers are standing by. For your pledge drive. But it's just so important that we have media that smarts us up, that we have tour guides that don't make travel just fun in the sun and the beach and duty-free shopping and frequent flyer miles. You know, it's a very interesting struggle, I think, and it's people are hungry to be smartened up. They don't want to be dumbed down. But powerful forces in our society would find it convenient if we're all just dumbed down. Germany has learned that. Germany knows what happens when you have a dumbed down electorate. This is my own little take on that, but I swear when I go to Germany, I find government initiatives designed to smart up the electorate, regardless of what political parties in power, whatever their needs are. They all know that a smartened up electorate is better for the democracy that they live in. And you'll find a lot of initiatives in Germany, because of their hard history, designed to make their electorate smarter. That is national security, if you ask me. One thing great about travel is you meet a lot of people. You meet people you normally wouldn't encounter. You know, we meet interesting people here, but, you know, you kind of self-select, and there are people that don't rearrange your cultural furniture too much. You go to Europe, and you're sitting next to people that really see things differently than you, and it's a celebration. I just love encountering people in my travels. It doesn't need to be big, earth-shaking encounters. I mean, goofy little things. I was in Italy recently, and this little kid was just staring at me. It was kind of rude. Finally, his dad said, "Excuse my son. He stares at Americans." And I said, "Well, why is that?" And he said, "Well, last week at McDonald's, we were having our hamburger, and my son asked, 'Dad, why do Americans have such soft bread?' Noticing the hamburger bun, you know?" And the dad said, "Well, it's because Americans have no teeth." I don't think the guy meant anything by that. He was just entertaining himself by confusing his son. But now the poor son is all confused and looks at tourists to see if they have teeth. And I showed him mine. And it just reminded me there's a lot of funny misconceptions floating around that when we travel, we can overcome. One of my favorite places to travel is Ireland. I love traveling in Ireland, and I think I like traveling so much in Ireland because in Ireland, I have the sensation that I'm understanding a foreign language. You know what I mean? I've never really known what it's like to understand a foreign language, but when I'm in Ireland, these people have a incredible, lilting, poetic gift of gab. They are enthusiastic and beautiful conversationalists. And a lot of Americans don't realize this, but I mean, this is my own personal theory. I think traditional Irish people that are going to charm you with their lilt and everything are people who think like they speak in Gaelic. See, these guys on the west coast of Ireland, where they say, where they look out at the sea and they say, the next parish over is Boston, all right? Those people, they speak Gaelic first and English second. They live in areas that are shaded green on the map called Gaeltachts. You see, in Ireland, they recognize that certain aspects of their culture are worth subsidizing just because it lets people know from where they came. You know, it's not good for business. It's just good for your culture to have family farms and traditional lifestyles. You know, here, that might just be considered stupid. Get smart, you know? Well, Ireland affords subsidizing its heritage. And they have these Gaeltachts, where the big city kids go summertime to learn to dance Gaelic and speak a little Gaelic and so on. And you meet people who speak Gaelic first. You stepped up to these guys, they're talking with each other in Gaelic, they turn to you, speak English, then you say goodbye, and they turn back to their Gaelic. And the tourist doesn't even realize they speak Gaelic first, you see. And their beautiful conversational skills are enough just to mess up your itinerary. I get into these conversations, and it occurs to me, I could care less what museum I'm missing. I'm talking to some very interesting guys, and I'll remember that conversation for the rest of my life. I was talking to these guys. After a while, I asked the guy there on the left, I said, were you born here? He said, no, it was about 5 miles down the road. Later on, I asked him, have you lived here all your life? He said, not yet. I mean, you just gotta love that when you're in Ireland. Well, the big news for me as a travel teacher, and understand my beat is Europe. So I could be an expert on Central America or Asia or whatever, but I just do Europe, okay? I mean, I've traveled in different places for my own political fun and so on, but my profession really is being up to date on Europe. And I see Europe as the wading pool for world exploration. People can go there first, get confident, and then they can head off and do other things more exciting in the more challenging parts of the world. But I need to be up to date on Europe, so I focus on that, and I'm really determined not to have mission creep. I just want to make my Europe books as good as I can with my staff. And so my anecdotes are about Europe. The big news in Europe, of course, is the unification of Europe, the establishment of the EU. Can you imagine 1947... Europhiles, Eurovisionaries, European statesmen, European people who care, sitting in the rubble of a bombed-out continent, remembering World War I, considering World War II, looking into a fragile and scary future. They got together and said, look, we got to do something so we don't blow ourselves to smithereens again in one generation. We've got to create a United States of Europe. We've got to interweave our economies to the degree where France and Germany will never again go to war. And for 60 years, they've been working on just that. It's tough because you got to talk sovereign nations into trading away real sovereignty. That's a very tough sell. People like being Danish or German or French or Portuguese, and they really don't want to be like the other guys. But there are certain driving concerns that can trump those national bits of pride, and they are fitfully evolving into a union. It's every time we see a headline, it's going back. But they go two step forwards, one step back, two step forward, one step back, and they're moving, and Europe, you know, it's here to stay. Now, Europe is laughable in its political correctness and its bureaucracies and its many different, burdens they put on their society. And I'll tell you one thing, I'm really glad I run my business here in the United States rather than over there. It would be very frustrating. I think it would be demoralizing to be a guerrilla business person in Europe because it's just too cumbersome to work within all those constraints. They've got pros, they've got advantages because of that, but from a businessman's point of view, it's burdensome, okay? And I'm glad I can run my free-willing business here because we have an environment for that. And when I talk over the course of this this discussion or this talk about things I think are good about Europe, a lot of people think it's America bashing, and I just don't understand that. You know, this is my home. I would live nowhere else. I'm an American through and through. I love living in America. I would never live in Europe. And I just feel like it's America loving. When you learn about the rest of the world and you come home and you encourage your countrymen to learn from other people who are dealing with the same challenges we are. So it's certainly not insulting our country to remind us that other people have a different solution to a problem that's befuddling us, you see. So I hope you can understand the spirit of that. But when I'm thinking about the European Union, they have created this free trade zone of 400 million people, and it has its problems, and it has its struggles, and it has its silliness, but the fundamental triumph of Europe is to weave the economies of Germany and France together, so by almost everybody's assessment right now, there will be no more big wars in Europe. That makes all the other silly problems nothing compared to the triumph of having a Europe that's not going to go to war again. I just love that. Now, when we think about Europe, it is created not only to have peace, but to create a free trade zone that can compete with the United States. It was just economic survival. Europe is a free trade zone of 400 million people with a production every year of $13 trillion. To put it in perspective, here in the United States, we are a free trade zone of 300 million people with the same production, $13 trillion. Now, who knows what this current economic problem is going or what this, you know, it's an anomaly right now. But basically, we have these two economies that are similar. We produce more per person, and a lot of people who are proponents of our system and threatened by the European system will say, look at those Europeans, this liberal sort of idealistic basket case of an economy. They make less money than we do. Well, the complete sentence is they make less money per person than we do, but they choose to work less than we do. And by any estimate, they make as much as we do per hour. We just are hell-bent on working ourselves into an early grave by some people's estimate. I've got a friend in Seattle who's running a little movement, a very small movement called Take Back Your Time. And their goal is to explain to Americans that we have the shortest vacations in the rich world, and it's getting worse. And his national holiday is October 23rd. Because by his estimate, if you were a European and you worked as hard as Americans do, October 23rd would be the last day you got to go to work. It's an annoying thought, isn't it? So it's not a right or a wrong thing. It's just a fact. We work much longer. We make a little more. But their system produces as much per hour as we do. Now, there's an energy in Europe, which is quite exciting. And there's also a playfulness in Europe that is quite inspiring. Here it is, Wednesday afternoon in Amsterdam. And I look at these guys and I think, what are you doing? It's a work day. And they say, no, it's Wednesday afternoon. This is, we're playing, okay? Now, they work hard. I mean, all over Europe, they're working really hard. But they have a different sort of setup where they've got, you know, 6 weeks paid vacation. They got 14 months of paid parental leave to be split by the mom or the dad any way they like. It's use it or lose it. There's a lot of heavy-handed dictates that you must live well. You've got a baby, stay home and nurture it. You know, I mean, that kind of goes against our sort of sensibilities. But in Europe, it's a different sort of system. And when you travel over there, you see that it's not all good. There's a lot of demonstrations in Europe right now. You'll see there's a million people marching in Paris this week, right? What are they marching about? Well, Sarkozy just told them, you're not going to get the promise of a retirement when you're 60. You got to work till you're 62. And they're angry. Europeans love to demonstrate. When there's any problem, they get out and march. That's too much exercise for Americans. So we just stay at home and listen to TV and radio that makes us affirms our anger, you know? But in Europe, they get out there and they march. It's really interesting. Now, if you look what's happening in Europe, I think you can learn a lot about our economic problems by looking at Europe's. It's so cool to go away from your country and then look back and see things in higher contrast. Or go to other countries that are having the same problem and see how they're dealing with it. What are the symptoms of it and so on. We have this big real estate bubble. They had a big real estate bubble. I was just in Ireland a few years ago. It had the Celtic Tiger economy. It was the hottest economy in Europe. Your little $100,000 hovel is now worth $800,000, you know? Well, that's just silly. And all of a sudden, your hovel's worth $100,000 again. Well, you didn't just lose $800,000, $700,000. You were never that rich. you know, I've got American friends who had a $500,000 house. Then it was worth $1 million. Now it's worth $500,000 again. And they act like they just lost $500,000. You didn't. You conned yourself into thinking you were richer than you really are. Now suck it up and go out there and work. By any estimate, we are very affluent, all right? We just have a funny way of dividing wealth in our society, but as a whole, we got it good, all right? It can be better, it could be worse. And people tell us, you know, how tough it is. A cool thing about travel is it lets you get a little bit of a grip on that. Now, in Greece, it's even worse, isn't it? Greece played it even worse than the rest of Europe and us in a lot of living beyond its means. And here's a good example. In Greece, they're having all these riots because a couple months ago, they made a change in the retirement age. And if you were just a couple months different age than your friend, you might get to retire at 59, and your friend has to work until he's 67. 8 years of hard labor because you missed that cutoff. That's enough to make anybody get out on the streets and burn a few Starbucks, you know? Now, when you think about the roots of this, you just got to think of simple arithmetic. All of our entitlements and all of their entitlements are sort of based on this notion that a lot of people are working, not many are retiring, and those who retire don't live very long. You can sustain that. Now in our modern age, fewer people are working because wealthy societies have fewer kids, less of a working force, more people living to retirement, and then they live a long, long time. Now that's just not going to work. It just doesn't add up. You can't tell a hardworking person who worked under the same contract and promise of his father or mother that you're not going to get the same entitlements. They're just not going to accept that. But that's the reality. That's what politicians are having to explain to their people, and you can see it here, and you can see it over there, and it's going to be an interesting sorting out time. But there is the new reality that fewer people are working and more people are living too long. The big news in Europe, of course, is the spread to the east. Oh, by the way, some people say, is it safe to travel in Greece? Yes, I was just there. I went there. I go when people are thinking, is it safe to go there, then that's when I go there, just to check it out. And if it's not safe, I'll tell you. But Greece was great, and people love to have visitors, and the water's running, the boats are working, the salads are tasty, the dancing's great. Greece was wonderful for me this summer. We take a lot of tours to Greece. Conventional wisdom here from people who have never been to Greece and just read the headlines say, oh, you don't want to go over to Greece. You know, when the teachers decide to have a demonstration in front of the parliament building in Greece, the anarchists go, hey, here's a riot just asking to happen. And they get on their little scooters and they go down to the main square and they break a few windows and burn a car and they're on the news. It's a beautiful thing if you're an anarchist. I mean, you don't have to kill anybody or anything. It's just you burn a few cars and you got the whole city in flames and the whole nation in flames as far as the world's viewpoint on Greece. So, I mean, that's exciting if you're in the news business and trying to sell ads, but if you're traveling and you wonder, is it safe to go there, don't judge it by what your neighbor thinks or what you see on the news, all right? You can talk to people there and find out what it's like. Now, the big news, as I mentioned, is moving east in Europe. Of course, a couple years ago, virtually the entire Warsaw Pact joined the European Union. Overnight, there's 100 million new capitalists in Europe. The geographic center of Europe shifts from Belgium to the Czech Republic. And you go to places like Poland, and it's a festival of pent-up entrepreneurial spirit. Wow, we can work hard and have a cabin and a car. It's just great. And it's so exciting to see that. You see that all over Eastern Europe. And it's an interesting dynamic because Western Europeans are looking at the Eastern Europeans going from some sort of communalism idealism to a radical capitalist work hard kind of thing, and everything is out of moderation, and you've got people in Eastern Europe that feel like it was better in the old times than it is today, and it's just very poignant, very confusing, very complicated. From a travel point of view, it's a great time to be in Eastern Europe. Things are much better than they were. There's great infrastructure all over Eastern Europe. And here in Poland, there's an energy in the streets. One thing I love about Europe is the variety. You travel 100 miles and it's often a whole different country, a whole different language, a whole different history and heritage and culture. When you celebrate the variety of Europe and you hear about Europe uniting, you kind of think, is this threatening the variety of Europe as it becomes one big country and 300 million people have the same coins in their pockets and there's no more borders and governments are paying their teachers and their students to study in a foreign country just so they can be a little more worldly? Is that going to make it all melt together? And the answer is no. Counterintuitively, it makes the cultural variety in Europe more vivid. Let me explain why. Throughout our sort of thinking about Europe in the last couple generations, headlines have been filled by regions challenging nations, right? Basque people threatening Madrid. Celtic people in Brittany trying to break away from Paris. Scottish and Irish people just frustrating London. And all of these sort of secession groups. Now, as Europe is uniting, we find there's three levels of loyalty: region, nation, or Europe. And as Europe becomes more powerful, the nations realize they are not going to be players in the future. And the European government in Brussels loves ethnic variety. It subsidizes the ethnicities, and the nations are no longer threatened by that because while the Catalonian people can secede from Spain, they cannot secede from Europe. Do you follow me there? Britain people in Brittany can secede from France, but they just can't secede from Europe. Brussels is not threatened by them, and Brussels likes the ethnic variety. Brussels celebrates and funds the ethnic variety. In your travels, you'll find a lot of indication of this, and as travelers, it's important for us to be tuned into that. For instance, every city hall in Europe now, it seems, has three flags flying: the regional flag, the country flag, and the European flag. Ask somebody in Munich, where are you from? You don't know what he's going to say. He may say, I'm Bavarian. For 600 years, the Wittelsbach family ruled a moderately sized power called Bavaria. Or he might say, I'm German, because for 150 years, that's been a German country. Or he might say, I'm European. If you ask somebody in Barcelona, where are you from? He might say, I'm Catalonian, or I'm Spanish, or I'm European. For the first time since 1707, Scotland has a parliament in Scotland, not in London. Why does London let the Scottish people have their parliament in Edinburgh? Because London doesn't really care about Scottish secessionist movements or independence or anything like that. It's okay now. It's an interesting change. Now you can have your sacred Sardana dance outside of the cathedral after Mass on Sunday in Barcelona. If these people got together and did that a couple decades ago, they'd be arrested. Right? Now in Barcelona, people speak Catalan first. The schools are Catalan first, Spanish second. You can fly your actual flag instead of your soccer team's flag when you want to show your patriotic spirit. This is exciting times. And when you go to an ATM machine in Barcelona and you look at the language buttons, you learn a little bit about the people. When you go to Spain, you realize, oh, nowadays it's quite ethnic variety. You go to a Subway sandwich shop in Madrid, the menu may have four different languages on it, and they're all Spanish languages. Go to the ATM machine in Barcelona, on the top, you would have Catalan for the people who are local. Then here you got Espanol for most of the Spanish people, Gallego for people from Galicia, the northwest of Spain, and Euskara for the Basque people, all Spanish languages. And then you would have German, French, English, and everybody else. Now, if you went to an ATM machine in Basque country, you would find the same thing. Because as a matter of solidarity, the Basque people will always have Catalan people on their language buttons. Not because Catalonian people who go to Basque country would need that, because they'd speak Spanish or English, you know. But it's just a matter of respect to your other ethnic underdog brothers and sisters that you will show them the respect you want when you're in their country. When I was in Barcelona, I asked my friends, I'm trying to straighten it out. Okay, you live in the region of Catalonia, right? No, we're not a region. That implies we're part of Spain. We are a nation without a state. You see, they consider themselves a nation without a state. There's a lot of nations without states, and there's a lot of frustration among them because they're not getting the respect they deserve, and the European Union is good news for them. For instance, this man is the Indiana Jones of Tyrolean archaeologists. His name is Armin Walsch, and he loves nothing more than to renovate old castles and turn them into wonderful celebrations of medieval culture and history and teach people about their heritage. When he wants money for a very expensive project like this, he does not go to Vienna because he won't get any money. He goes to Brussels. And when he goes to Brussels, he doesn't say, I've got something really cool for Austria. Even though he lives in Austria, he knows he'll go home empty-handed. He goes to Brussels, and he talks to the European Union people, and he says, I have a project for the Tyrol. Tyrolia, the Tyrolean people. That's an ethnic region that is part Italy and part Austria that ignores modern political borders, which oftentimes make no sense from an ethnic point of view. And he'll go home with money, again, because Brussels is funding that kind of diversity in Europe. Now, when you join the European Union, you're either a net giver or a net receiver, depending on your nation's economy. Back when European Union was really in the news, the three poorest countries were Ireland, Greece, and Portugal. And I remember traveling in all three of those countries when there were literally no freeways. Now each of those countries is laced with fancy German-style, German-quality freeways. And with every freeway, you'll see a European flag that says, brought to you by the European Union. In other words, this freeway was built here in Ireland by the people of Germany and France. Now, enjoy it and work and produce, because we're going to keep up with the United States. That's their infrastructure. Just like when the United States was investing in its infrastructure in the 50s with Eisenhower, making the interstate system, they didn't let rich states have better roads than poor states. I believe it was federally funded because they really wanted to have, believed that the weakest link was an important thing to make higher, and they have one uniform set of infrastructure so everything can get around. Europe has that philosophy. I was just in Greece, and for all my life, I've been crossing the Gulf of Corinth by ferry, and all of a sudden, I come to Greece last time, and there's this big new bridge. And my first thought is, Greeks don't build bridges like this. They'd take the ferry for the rest of time. This is a German bridge built by Germans to take German trucks over that gulf to get their gummy bears down to the Peloponnesian Peninsula. And you find that all over Europe. They've just built an incredible bridge from Denmark over to Sweden. They're drilling the longest tunnels in the world through the mountains of Norway to lace together towns that were previously isolated on fjords. You got bullet trains going faster and faster all over the place. Huge train stations being built. This is the new train station in Berlin, where you've got trains coming together at different levels on right angles. Super trains. Oh, man. I was just at the train station in Munich taking pictures of trains coming into the station. Actually, more accurately, taking pictures of cute little birds squished under the windshields of these trains. And when I saw that adorable little bird squished under that windshield, I thought two things. I thought, this is a dangerous place if you're a slow bird. And I also thought, you'd wait all your life to see a bird squished to the windshield of a train where I live. But those darn Europeans, they just can't get fast enough, you know? And every time I go to Europe, I have to update my guidebooks because it takes less time to get from A to B. You know, there's faster roads, faster trains, more tunnels, more bridges. They've got their own sort of internal Marshall Plan. It's a very interesting system they got over there. Now, you see this. And you don't see it as much now as you did a few years ago, but you still see it, and you will see it. I just want to remind you, because I've been at this for 30 years now, and I take tours, you know, and I try to help my American travelers understand what the reception's going to be over there, and a lot of people take this personally. Don't take these things personally. You know, when you see something bad about America, they're angry with American foreign policy or trade policy, or something the president said, or some war that we're involved in. But they don't take it out on you. If they do, that person's just a little loony and you gotta write them off as a crackpot. I've been enjoying traveling, as I said, for so long. I've been to places you'd think I'd be, you know, blanketed in Canadian flags, and I've never found that you need this accessory in your travels. I would imagine, Elaine, at the book passage there sells a lot of Canadian flags to people that want to go there. And I know there's travel bookstore people that I've talked to. They remark on how many Americans want to buy Canadian flags. It's really not necessary. It's not necessary. In fact, everywhere I've been, I've found that people like American individuals. And I'll tell you one thing, the ideals of America. You know, the beautiful ideals of freedom and democracy and hard work and independence and all that kind of stuff. That's bigger than any one president's foreign policy or anything like that, and that's even bigger than our country. Those ideals will always be celebrated, and they'll always be considered, I think, American ideals, I hope. But you will find, you know, there's misunderstandings and frustrations with foreign policy and trade policy, and the more you learn about it, the more you think some of it is well-founded. I take about 1,000 people to France every year, and I'm concerned that they would have a good reception from the French people when they travel there, because a lot of Americans don't like travel all around France, but they won't go there because they don't want to be, you know, insulted by those French. You know, it's completely wrong. I survey our groups every year, and everybody says they were received warmly by the French. In fact, I've had experiences that would just blow you away. I could give a whole talk on amazing examples of how the French people appreciate America. I was filming a little while ago in the most traditional part of France, Burgundy. And when I'm filming, get out of my way. The sun's going down. I got to get up on your rooftop to get a nice shot of the ramparts. I'm really hell-bent on making a TV show. I don't have time to, you know, have a little party. But I came to this one castle here where I've been taking groups for 20 years. And the charming little mom-and-pop aristocratic family that's owned this castle for centuries in their family said, oh, we've got an American film crew. We must have a little party. No, I got to get up on the roof for the ramparts. No, we got to have a party. So, okay, I sit down. And they bring out the wine and the beautiful cheese and bread and everything. And then, with great reverence, they bring out this precious, like almost like a religious relic, 48-star American flag. And they unfurl it. And they say, this is the flag we hoisted over our chateau on that great day in 1944 when your American troops liberated us from Nazi tyranny. Oh, man, that was so touching and so beautiful. And they said, please, go home and tell your neighbors that we will always be thankful for the American strength and valor and compassion that rescued us from our darkest days, you know. And I hear this time and time again. And I'll tell you, when you think about the recent Cold War, Europeans generally appreciate that it was the United States' economic strength that outlasted the Soviet Union and overcame that threat. And they remember when Reagan said, Gorbachev, tear down this wall, and how we waged a battle of economic attrition, calculating, I think, that Russia, the Soviet Union, would bleed white and drop first. That was an expensive thing, but in actuality, it was a lot cheaper than a war, a hot war. And now Europe is no longer threatened by that expansive Soviet ideology. And Europeans are thankful for that. So Europeans will not march in lockstep with us today because they're self-respecting, independent nations that know what a war is. But that doesn't mean they're not thankful for what we've done for them in the past. A lot of Americans are quick to call Europeans wimps and surrender monkeys or something like that. But I would remind those Americans that nobody in the United States remembers what it's like to host a war. You know, Europe knows what it's like to host a war. I mean, the hell of a war. We lost a lot of people on 9/11, and we've lost a lot of people in Iraq and in Afghanistan. France, with 1/4 of our population, lost as many people as we've lost in 9/11, Afghanistan, and Iraq, all put together in one day. And it happened many times. It was routine for France to lose that many people over a weekend. And by the end of World War I, half of all the men in France between the age of 15 and 30 were casualties. That's a war. Europe has baggage. We've got baggage. We've got Vietnam baggage. We've got 9/11 baggage. You know, I grew up with depression baggage and that kind of thing. Europe's got baggage. We need to respect that. They are more pacifistic than us because they don't think wars are something to be taken lightly. And it's not right or wrong, it's just if we're going to have friends in Europe, we need to understand that's their heritage. They tend to think war is a last resort. Now, there's a lot of... There's a lot of people in Europe that I know who are a few years older than me named Frankie and Johnny. This is a Frankie here. And they were named in a time when people named their kids after GIs and pop stars from America, when they were just enamored with America for what we our stance in the world and so on. And I really think it's fun to psychoanalyze who's getting named in each decade and why, you know. And it's just too bad people aren't naming their kids Frankie and Johnny in Europe these days. It could happen again. But we have something called the brand of America. And if you're just interested in trade, this is an important thing. I was lobbying in Washington, D.C. A while back for Bread for the World, trying to get our government to relieve the third world debt in some very, very poor country, where countries where half of their national income was going to the first world every year in interest on their debt, which, if you learn more about that, you'll understand why that's worth going to Washington, D.C. and lobbying for. When I was talking to these legislators, good, caring people, but they have to be responsive to their constituents and so on, and things that resonated with them were the brand of America, because they want to be able to sell products in these countries, and if nobody likes America, they're not going to buy our products. There was a time when American jingles sold cars in Europe. And then there was a whole decade when marketing agents were hired to comb everything that smelled like America out of their advertising jingles so they could sell cars. You see, I mean, there is a brand of America problem. The brand of American could be a very powerful thing, and it'll be good for our economy if people like what we stand for. The other issue was the notion of soft power over hard power. I'll talk more about that later on. But there is a recognition now in Washington, D.C., that maybe because we're motivated by our economic needs and our national security needs. I mean, forget altruism, to be frank, you know. It's just economic needs and national security needs. So you got to spin your altruism in a way that lets people who are motivated by that embrace it. So if you want to spin your compassion, you call it soft power instead of hard power. If you're going to invest $1 million to keep one soldier in Afghanistan for 1 year, which we do, that's hard power. What could you do to win hearts and minds and make people appreciate America instead of wanting to hurt America if you took that $1 million and you figured out a clever way to make soft power? You could do a lot. And you could argue that that's more constructive than the hard power. You see, that's that. I learned that on that trip. That's that notion of soft power that is actually saleable in America today. Terrorism. I wish I didn't have to talk about terrorism, but there's always been terrorism. There always will be terrorism, and Americans will always be targeted. It's just because of what the rest of the world sees when they look at our country. They see 4% of this planet that spends as much as everybody else put together on the military. A country where you can't even get elected without promising more for the military. It doesn't matter what I think or what you think. It really matters what 96% of humanity thinks. Educated people that look at us without our media conditioning our perspective, you see. They don't have the media that we have. When they look at us, they see a nation that has military bases in 140 different countries. There's only one country on the planet that can do that. They look at us and they see a country that can declare other people's natural resources on the opposite side of the planet, quote, vital to our national security interests. And the people who are sitting on those natural resources wish we were just candid enough to say, at least vital to our accustomed material lifestyle. But we say vital to our national security interests, and then, you know, Americans can embrace that. Well, when I write in my blog about the empire of America, I'm not talking about what I think. I'm talking about how people who don't like us see us as an empire. That's the perception. Therefore, that's really the reality. We're dealing with a world that looks at us as an empire. There's never been an empire in the history of mankind that didn't have angry people on the fringes nipping at its borders. The empire always insults them by calling them something very bad, barbarians or anarchists or terrorists, to rally their people against them. We think it would be just decent if they would simply line up in formation and attack us like a self-respecting force, and then we could carpet bomb them, you know. But they shoot in from the bushes. Darn them. And that's what they're going to do. You're hopelessly outgunned. You either got to agree or you die or you shoot in from the bushes. You know, and they're not going to agree. They don't want to die. They're going to shoot in from the bushes. So either you got to change your stance on the planet or get used to having angry people on your fringes nipping at you. It's not very consequential. I mean, it's actually pretty overrated when you think about terrorism. I'm not talking about the danger of a dirty bomb in our country or something mass kind of thing inside. I'm talking about American individuals like you and me who want to travel, who are concerned about terrorism. How risky is that? It weighs on us heavy. How many Americans have died traveling overseas in the last decade because of terrorists? A couple hundred, maybe. 12 million Americans go to Europe every year. 12 million come back. Bomb in Madrid, tragic. Local people die. No Americans hurt. 12 million Americans come back. Bomb in London, another tragedy. 12 million Americans go, 12 come back. Tomorrow, if an American is beheaded by a jihadist in Madrid, it doesn't matter. We're a mighty nation of 300 million people. We lose lots of people. That's what happens when you just move around. We lose 70,000 people every year on our freeways because we want to drive fast. You could save 20,000 people, conservative estimate, every year if you just agreed to drive 50 miles an hour instead of 70. Are you going to drive 50 miles an hour instead of 70 to save 20,000 lives? Hell no. Get real. We're a mighty nation of 300 million people. A few people are going to die, but I got to get there. We choose to have the precious right to bear arms. This could be a good thing or a bad thing. I could be sold either way, I suppose. It's just a point. We, as an educated free society, year after year, affirm that it's worth losing 13,000 people a year to handguns in order to have the right to bear arms. Good enough. Now, 13,000 people, well, that's crummy, but we're 300 million that enjoy the right to bear arms, and that's really important. Now, European societies have a different take on it. Sure, it would be nice to have your own gun, but they choose not to have guns because they don't like violence. They don't have that right. And they lose 1/8 of the people we do per capita to violence on their streets. It's a choice a society makes. It's not right or wrong. You're free. You're educated. Just vote. You want guns. You're going to lose 1,000 people a month. It doesn't make headlines. It's routine. Europeans laugh out loud when they hear that Americans are staying home for safety reasons. If you care about your loved ones, you will take them to Europe tomorrow, for crying out loud. That's how I sell tours. And, you know, really, if you really are concerned about terrorism, you realize the most dangerous thing we can do as a society is to stop traveling because of the risk of terrorism. That is really scary. Then they'll have their way with you. And you're going to need walls, and you're going to need guns, and you're not going to be able to engage with the rest of the world. That's a horrible result. A cool thing about traveling is you realize that all these different countries have different 4th of Julys. I love that. I used to think the 4th of July was like the party, you know, kids would. You go over there and you're in Switzerland on August 1st, and they're having the 4th of July. You go to Norway on May 17, it's the same thing. 10 days after our 4th of July, we've got the 14th of July in France. Everything's going crazy. It's fun to recognize that every different country has its own passions and celebrations. It's also fun to realize that every different country has its own dreams. I, until well into my adulthood, believed the world is a pyramid with us on top and everybody else trying to figure out how to get there. We were the model. And then I traveled, and I realized smart people wouldn't trade passports. They don't have the American dream. They got the Bulgarian dream, or the Moroccan dream, or the Sri Lankan dream. These are Sri Lankans here. They don't want to live like you and me. They really don't, believe it or not. I mean, they want to have stability and enough economy to raise their kids well and so on, but they don't really have the same dream we have. I used to be threatened by that, and now I celebrate that. I think it's a beautiful thing. Another thing you realize when you travel is different people have different kind of passions, different crusades. It's humbling. I remember sitting in a cafeteria once in Kabul in Afghanistan, and I was just doing the backpacker thing, going through Afghanistan, and a man sat down next to me, and he said, "Can I join you?" And I said, "You already have." And he said, "You're an American, aren't you?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "I'm a professor here in Afghanistan, and I want you to know that 1/3 of the people on this planet eat with spoons and forks like you do. 1/3 of the people eat with chopsticks, and 1/3 of the people eat with their fingers like I do, and we're all just as civilized." Ooh, he had a chip on his shoulder. I thought about this a lot after that, because that was an interesting experience, you can imagine. And for the rest of my trip, I was thinking about that guy. I thought, you know, he probably thought, I thought he was less civilized because he used his fingers for what God intended them to be used for. Whereas we had evolved to have metal utensils to put metal in our mouth when we nourished ourselves. And I actually got into a frame of mind where I was eating with my fingers like well-dressed professional people do all over India when they go out to a nice restaurant. I went to all sorts of great restaurants where there were no silverware. There was a ceremonial sink in the middle of the room, and people, not peasants, people of all walks of life, they washed their hands and they ate with their fingers. And I got very comfortable with that. I had to be retrained when I got home. But when you travel, you realize that all over the world, you've got these passions and these concerns. And you also realize that Nathan Hales and Patrick Henrys and Ethan Allens are a dime a dozen on this planet. Now, that doesn't put ours down at all. It just says they're not uniquely courageous and patriotic and filled with valor and spine. Why would we have more spine than somebody else? If anything, we should have less spine because we're the redcoats now. The other people are struggling. Every country has its own Nathan Hales, Patrick Henry, and Ethan Allens, local heroes that only wish they had more than one life to give for their country. And in your travels, you can find these people. It's really exciting to find present-day Nathan Hales in your travels. One good example would be if you go down to Central America, specifically El Salvador, and you get to know Archbishop Oscar Romero, a modern-day Nathan Hale. He stood with his people as the landless people stood up against the big landlords and so on, and they had a terrible civil war, and the people lost, and the landlords won, and now that country is dollarized, and there's a Wendy's and a Dunkin' Donut on every corner. It's a gripping thing. I've been down there on three different tours, educational tours, and my most recent trip was on the 25th anniversary of the assassination of Archbishop Oscar Romero. He stood in front of his congregations at Mass, and he said, I'm standing with the people. I'm a leader in my society. I'm standing with the people's need, and I'll probably be gunned down, and I'll rise again in my people. And the next month, they shot him dead, and he rose in his people. And I got to march with those people on the 25th anniversary of his assassination. And I'll tell you, that was the same week my family and I had planned a break on the west coast of Mexico. We're going to go to Mazatlan, and I was ready for a vacation. I mean, I was ready for a nice stretch of pristine tropical beach, swept free of local riffraff, where I could just be there, you know? And then they invited me to go to El Salvador. And I told my family, I'm not going to be fun on the beach in Mazatlan. I got to do this. This is going to be so exciting. And I was marching with those people. I was covered with bug bites. I was eating rice and beans one day and beans and rice the next, spending a quarter of what we would have spent in Mazatlan and having 10 times the experience. It occurred to me, very poignant, that is so perverse what I just chose. El Salvador over Mazatlan, you know? And it was such a slam dunk good investment for me because I have a passion to understand the reality on this planet and to empathize with people who are struggling. The half of humanity trying to live on a couple bucks a day, you see. It's not a noble thing, it's just an awake thing. I'm so thankful for that, you see. I'm so thankful for that. On that march, we stopped by a monument in El Salvador. And I saw that monument, I thought, I've seen that monument before. This is a knockoff of a much-loved monument we have in Washington, D.C., with 50,000 names chipped into it also. And it occurred to me, this is just as many names chipped into it. And I had never heard of it. And I talked to loved ones who come and remember their lost family members there and so on. And I realized every one of those names died fighting my country, if truth be told. Now, maybe they were communists and they needed to be killed, you know. I don't want to get into that. But the reality is, they lost as many people as we lost in Vietnam, and they've got, what, 5 million people in their country. I don't know what the ratio is, but that's devastating. And you and I may have an excuse for why the left-wingers lost and so on, but in their heart, they were killed fighting a noble struggle against American corporations, and now they've got this memorial left, and a widow, you see. this is baggage that we have to deal with, and it is just smart for us to appreciate it and learn about it. That's why I went to Iran. A couple of years ago, I had the great opportunity to go to Iran. It was so exciting. It was scary also. There was agitation, sort of saber-rattling, and we were concerned that there's going to be military action in Iran. And I just thought it's naive if we have another Iraq when it can be avoided. You know, I just think that's naive, and I think Iraq is nothing compared to fighting Iran. And I thought if I can do anything to let calmer voices prevail so we can look for an alternative to war, that would be nice. The United Nations in Seattle asked me what we can do. I said the only thing I can do of any consequence would be make a TV show. But I don't have the time and the energy to get it organized. But I said, if you can get a visa for me, I can put the crew together, write a script, and I'll pay for the production, and we'll make a TV show, and I bet it'll air all over the United States. And they got me a visa. So I had to do it. And I was scared. We came within this much of leaving our big camera in Athens and just going in with our little sneak camera. And thank goodness I went in with our big camera. Because I've never received such a warm welcome on the streets of any country that I can remember traveling in as I received in Iran when they learned that I was an American. And I'm supposed to know this stuff. I was blown away by how my misperceptions of Iran were just completely polluting my perspective. Now, it's a very poignant thing to be working in Iran because Tehran is an interesting place. It's a city of 12 or 14 million people with a lot of traffic. And they don't have traffic lights at a lot of major intersections. It's just, I thought the traffic lights must be broken. No, they never bothered making traffic lights. They just, they just kind of vibrate through and spring on and carry on, you see. And it seems to work for them. Crossing the street, this is just crazy. The local phrase for crossing the street in Iran is going to Chechnya. You don't say, I'm going to cross the street. You say, I'm going to Chechnya. And then you do this. And so there we are, going to Chechnya and waiting in traffic jams. And all around us, we've got 10-story tall banners that say, down with the USA, made with dropping bombs and skulls, you know. Very poignant and very painful to see that. And very confusing because the people you meet are so different than their propaganda. Now, you and I know the propaganda. That's all we hear about. And people who hate Iran because of their propaganda, I think, and the media here. I was down there stuck in a traffic jam. I remember being stuck in a traffic jam one time, and the guy in the next car asked my driver to roll down the window. He handed over a bouquet of flowers, and he said, give this to the foreigner in your back seat and apologize for our traffic. I just thought, first thing I thought is, that never happens in Seattle, you know? I don't know about here, but that doesn't happen in Seattle. Later on, I was in another traffic jam, and we're just sitting there quietly. And suddenly, my driver just blurts out, death to traffic. And I kind of had one of those double takes, and I thought, wait a minute, I thought it was death to Israel or death to America. He said, no, right now it's death to traffic. And I said, well, what's with that? And he said, here in Iran, anytime something's really frustrating to us and out of our control, we say death to that. And then I thought about it, and I thought, you know, well, he doesn't speak English as a first language. He's very limited in his English. He speaks Farsi. And what is death? That's damn. You know, damn America, damn the traffic. And I thought, well, now that's really puts a whole different light on it. And I thought myself, you know, I think on occasion I've thought, damn those teenagers. Damn those teenagers. Now, do I really want them to die and burn in hell for an eternity? I don't think so. It's just, it's after midnight. Turn down the music. You see, that is, it doesn't excuse Iran for saying naughty things, but death, too, is a translation of damn. And we jump on it as an excuse to go to war. We mark my words. I mean, this is an amazing thing. If you can distill it onto a bumper sticker and you got a dumbed-down electorate, you got yourself a war, all right? And when you go to Iran, you learn it's a more complicated issue than that. Ah, it's a rich, beautiful culture, 70 million people, with a history going back 1,200 years before Muhammad. They are fundamentally Zoroastrian, not Muslim. Now, a lot of Americans are just pissed off at them for the treatment of Baha'is. You know, you can't worship as a Baha'i there. Well, I'm sorry. It's a theocracy. It's a theocracy. Their scripture is the law. And according to their scripture, you can worship anybody you want as long as he was before Muhammad, because Muhammad is the last prophet. Jesus, just fine. Jews, no problem. Baha'is, your guy came in the 19th century. Baha'u'llah, you can't worship him here. That blasphemes our guy. Now, is that nice? No. Do I have any right to tell them you can't do that? Well, you could debate that, but I think it's inappropriate for a country here to tell them how they should follow their religion. If you're a Baha'i, it's not a good place to be. You got to get out or be secret, you see? It doesn't excuse it, but that's the way it is. We need to understand that before we jump to conclusions. I think when you go to Iran, you realize they have really painful baggage that most of us cannot understand. We have the Vietnam War, we have 9/11, we lost a lot of people, it's tragic. They got their own stuff like that. They lost 300,000 people with one quarter of our population. That's like a lot of people per person. When they were invaded by Saddam Hussein, who was funded by the United States. Nobody disputes that. Saddam Hussein, with American aid, invaded Iran, and they lost 300,000 people. You may think there's excuses for it, or it's inaccurate, or whatever, but that doesn't matter. There's 300,000 widows. Once a week, go to their martyrs' cemetery in every town in Iran, vast martyrs' cemeteries, and they sob. They sob on the tomb of their lost husband or son, and they curse America. These people are broken. Their loved one was killed, and their government and their media told them it was America. And they grew up with a guy named the Shah on the throne who was bragging the miniskirts are shorter in Tehran than they are in Paris, who was there, put in by United States and Britain when their democratically elected prime minister, Mossadegh, was thrown out in 1953 because he nationalized oil so they could control their own oil. So they lived for 30 years with the Shah, and that was a real insult to the sensibilities of the salt-of-the-earth people in Iran. I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I'm just saying this is the reality. I went to the National Museum there with my film crew. You can imagine if you're making a TV show in Iran, you want to go to the National Museum and film some beautiful stuff like you would in Athens or Paris or London. There's nothing in the National Museum in Tehran but a few broken vases. I say, where's all your good stuff? Perseus, Xerxes, Persepolis, all that great heritage. They said, if you want to see our patrimony, you got to go to the great museums in Europe to see it. Because time after time, people have come here and taken it over to the West, you see. So these are things you might say, just get over it, but they can't get over it. And they just are predisposed to embrace propaganda that makes them fear the West. And when I visited these people, I found that they were motivated by powerful feelings that are very similar to ours. I was standing on the street, just minding my own business as we were filming, and a woman came across the street, an educated woman, and she just kind of did one of these things on my chest. She said, you're an American, aren't you? And I said, yeah. American journalist. She said, yeah. And I said, yeah. She said, I want you to go home and tell the truth. We're united. We're strong. And we just don't want our little girls to be raised like Britney Spears. And I thought, whoa, I didn't realize that's what was driving this. But then I thought about it, and what keeps a guy like Ahmadinejad in power? It's not the sophisticated elites in a city like Tehran, it's the small town people. He gets elected by about 50%, right? When he says something crazy to us, is he talking to us? Of course not. He's doing what our politicians would call shoring up his political base, right? He's just stoking his base. And who's his base? The less educated, small town, fundamentalist parents, motivated by the same thing their counterparts are here. They're good, caring people motivated by fear and love. And they've got a government that's taken advantage of them with manipulative propaganda. It's a complicated thing. And it's so exciting to learn about it in your travels. And I'll tell you, you won't learn about it any other way than by going there. and anybody can go to Iran. You can get a visa, simple. The Lonely Planet Guide just came out in a new edition. You can get it at Book Passage. And you can go there just as easily as you could go to the Soviet Union in those days. You know, you need to take a tour or have a guide and have things figured out in advance. But it's a rich experience. I don't expect people to actually pick up and go to Iran. I don't think it's, you know, there's other places that are much more appealing. But I'll tell you, if you want a little understanding, that's a way to get it. I was so thankful to have public television share this sort of story. It wouldn't have seen the light of day anywhere else on the dial, I can promise you that, because advertisers were scared to death to be thought of as a Jane Fonda mouthpiece for the enemy, you know. I didn't have any underwriters get close to my Iran show, that's for sure. It wasn't even worth asking. But public television aired it because public television is committed to bringing this kind of information home regardless of advertiser support. Seems like a silly thing, but it's really important. And I believe it would be dangerously naive to think we could shock and awe these 70 million Iranians into any kind of compliance. You know, we got to figure out a way to work with them because they're just not going to, you know, go change by our force. It's interesting, when you go to Iran, you hear there's more nose jobs per capita than anywhere else. And I thought, yeah, right. And I got over there, and every 100 yards, there's a woman with a Band-Aid recovering from a nose job. And it occurred to me, I don't know exactly, but it just seems kind of natural, or makes sense that in Iran, women cannot show any shape of their body. And if they're dressed properly, there's no cleavage and no hair showing. All they can do is show their face and their hands. So their faces and hands are just like ravishing. And if you can improve your nose even a little bit with plastic surgery, you'll do it in Iran. I love watching people. I'm a great girl watcher. I'm on the road a lot, and it's entertaining for me. And I noticed in Iran, after about 5 days, I never looked below the chin anymore because there was never anything to see. And sort of a, you know, voluptuous, sort of ravishing, teasing, naughty woman in Iran shows a little hair right here. And after about a week, I found my eyes going up here. And it was quite exciting. I mean, you probably can't imagine what that's like, but if you spend a week in Iran, it just does really funny things to your way of looking at people, I'll tell you that. There's that modesty thing, and Americans are quick to put down Iranians because of how they treat their women. I think you can learn a little more about it and find out that it may not be a way we'd like, but it's an attempt to show respect for women. And they look at our society, and they see a society that dresses up women in hot pants and bikini tops and puts them on revolving pedestals at car shows to sell hot rods. And we say, well, of course, that's how you sell a car, you know. But they think that's disrespectful to women. So, I mean, that's just a little odd look at our society, but they would play that up, you can imagine, when they're reminding how to treat women. And in Iran, women cannot go to soccer games because they might hear the F word. Women can go to badminton and cricket, but they cannot go to soccer games. It's a fascinating thing to learn about. And when you go to, when I was having fun with this school group, I can still hear their teacher. I don't know what the Farsi was, but I know that she was saying, girls, you look like a bunch of floozies. This gentleman from the West is going to take your photograph. Now cover your hair. So they giggled and they got their hair all figured out, and then we were okay to take the picture. I think the reason I decided to finally write this book was because I was really excited about sharing information we couldn't include in our TV show in my journal. So I printed a 64-page journal, and I realized, well, that's a good part of this book here. So the journal I wrote is one of the chapters in this book, if you want a lot more information behind the scenes. And if you missed the TV show, it runs on KQED every once in a while, but you can always go to Hulu.com and just search for Iran and Rick Steves and watch that. But I think it's a very powerful hour. I was very excited and thankful to be able to bring that home. Okay, we're going to go in a few minutes. I want to talk about how some countries think they have more liberty than we do. And but I want to remind you, there's restrooms outside. We're going to go for just another half an hour. I hope I'm not talking too much. And I won't drag it out for that. But I want to answer a few questions, and then we've got a few more slides. And then afterwards, I'll be out in the lobby and can sign autographs or whatever you like. Book Passage does have books in the lobby. If you want to get the Travel as a Political Act book, this would be a good time to grab it. Let's take a 5-minute stretch, okay? Just 5 minutes, and then we will carry on. 5 minutes. Thank you.